A cry for help today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two shootings of black men by police this week in Louisiana and Minnesota. This pastor in Baton Rouge says all police shootings here in the U.S. are a national cry for help.
There's obviously a problem in our nation.
Also, how the Latino community in San Francisco reacted to an earlier police shooting that killed one of their own.
Alex Nieto's death was a tragedy. And at the same time, he's now been converted into a symbol of resilience and community love.
And later, why people in El Salvador don't reach for their cell phones to record police abuse.
It's not like we feel safe taking video of the police because who are we going to give it to?
Those stories and more today on The World. Let me start things off today on the show by reading you something. Impunity for state violence has resulted in the current human rights crisis and must be addressed as a matter of urgency. That is a line from a United Nations report that came out in January. State violence, the current human rights crisis, needs addressing urgently. The UN was not talking about Syria or Rwanda. They were talking about the United States. And now another police shooting of an African American, this time in a suburb of St. Paul in Minnesota. Last night, a man identified as Philando Castile was shot and killed during a traffic stop. Tragically, this happened soon after another fatal police shooting of a black man, Alton Sterling, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We've got Reverend Lee Wesley on the line. He's a pastor at the Community Bible Baptist Church in Baton Rouge. What are you hearing, Pastor, from people in your community? And what did last night's shooting of a man hundreds of miles away in St. Paul do to that discussion in Baton Rouge?
There's obviously a problem in our nation between our communities, particularly the African-American community and law enforcement. There's an element of mistrust on the part of the community and mistrust and fear from the police officers toward the community, and again, particularly the African-American community.
So what is your message to people, especially the African-American community, which is justifiably angry about these shootings?
There were three things we wanted to communicate. First of all, we want to express our condolence to the Sterling family. Let them know of our concern that we're praying for them. Second, we want to get the message out to our community. It is okay to protest. That's the American way, but just do so in a non-violent fashion. And then the third message we want to get over, we are grateful to our governor, to our mayor, calling in the U.S. Justice Department, that it will be thorough, that it will be transparent. But our concern was and is that the Justice Department publicly have stated they are investigating possible civil rights violations. We encourage them to expand their investigation, to investigate not only civil rights violations, but also the violation of any state and local laws as well, and to recommend to our local DA any appropriate action that need to be taken.
The whole world's watching as these shootings take place here in the United States. There are probably reporters from around the world descending on Baton Rouge. What do you think the rest of the world ought to know about police violence in the United States?
I think what the world ought to know, and perhaps the world does know, is that there are problems within our police department. And listen to this now. In any organization, you're going to have a few people who are not going to do the right thing. Let's identify them. Let's root them out. Get them out of law enforcement and into something else. Likewise, you're going to have people on the streets who do things contrary to the law. Let's deal with them appropriately. Baton Rouge is not unlike any other urban city in our nation. There are problems, and there are big problems between law enforcement and the local community. Again, particularly African-American men. We need to address the issue head on. We're not doing it. Two things need to happen. First of all, we need to make sure that our police department, our police officers, are trained properly on how to handle these situations so they will not ignite any violence. And then on the other hand, our local churches need to get busy meeting with people in our community, again, particularly African-American men, on how do you respond when a police officer approached you. So there are problems on both sides of the fence that we need to address. And that has to be done by a total community, both black and white.
Reverend Wesley, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your calling.
We're talking about police shootings in our Global Nation exchange on Facebook, and we want to know, what stories do you think we in the media are missing here and whose voices are getting left out? To chime in, just look for the Global Nation exchange on Facebook. While authorities investigate in places like St. Paul and Baton Rouge, one question that keeps coming up is, can police training make a difference here? Chuck Wexler spent years looking at police training in different parts of the world. He's with the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington. And he says on a trip to Scotland, he noticed something different.
As I was talking to one of the officers, Ferguson had been fresh in my mind, and all of the situations American police were facing. And as I looked at this recruit, even though, it was clear to me that police in Scotland, as a rule, don't carry firearms, it hit me like a ton of bricks that, well, if they don't carry firearms, how do they deal with similar situations? In other words, ones that don't deal with firearms, so knives and rocks and things like that. So what I did is I got 25 police departments, got called 25 police chiefs and said, look, you got to come to Scotland, and got my people I know in Police Scotland to agree to host us at their academy. And we really watched and listened about how they think about use of force very differently than we do.
Yeah, so for those 25 police departments from America in Scotland, were there eureka moments like, wow, we haven't even thought about this, taking guns out of the equation?
Well, I think that, 5 days there, and we spent time with them. And if you go to a place like Glasgow, Scotland is the knife capital of Europe. So it's not as though, the perception that Scotland doesn't have the same kind of incidents is the case. In fact, in Glasgow, we heard about, and I've actually went myself to do ride-alongs, that they do engage with people who have been drinking heavily or who are mentally ill and are using knives. But how you dealt with them and how you talk with them, a very different approach.
Yeah, well, talk about that a bit. I mean, how do the Scottish police train communications? I mean, a potential killer with a knife, what training goes into a cop's routine so that de-escalation happens?
Well, I think from a philosophical standpoint, they start at a lower level of force. The important difference between what Scotland does or in the UK for that matter is they start at a lower level in terms of use of force. They are talking, communicating, making eye contact, trying to humanize themselves. Sometimes, even in Scotland, for example, when they engage with someone who has a knife, after they start talking for a few minutes, they take off their hat. They want to appear as another human being. They will use mace. They use a form of pepper spray if they have to, or they will use a baton. But even in those cases, it's still not always used.
Did any of the things that were discussed in Scotland when you went there with those police departments, did any of those things get implemented anywhere in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, we have put out a publication, Guiding Principles on Use of Force. It's received a lot of attention. A number of departments are incorporating the principles. Baltimore, Nassau County, New York, Fairfax, Virginia. A number of departments have. They have become controversial in some places, but that's the nature of change in policing. What we do here is we focus on the major departments in the country. And quite frankly, the major departments in the country really, I think they understand this issue. I think every police department in this country is one incident away from, really seeing their city and department turned upside down. So I think as we've been through since the last almost 2 years, I think there's been a lot of changes in policing, and I think the changes are happening in cities that recognize that, there are better practices, there are better ways to handle this. And I think the guiding principles that we've put forward has helped reformulate police thinking in the United States.
Chuck Wexler, the executive director for the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maybe you know the name Alex Nieto, or maybe the names of victims of police shootings are too many now to keep track. In 2014, Alex Nieto was shot and killed by police officers in San Francisco. He was 28, the son of Mexican immigrants, and his death set off questions about racial profiling and gentrification in San Francisco, the city where he was born and grew up. Since then, there have been protests, there have been lawsuits, and as Shuka Kalantari reports, the Latino community in San Francisco is also trying to heal through theater.
We're at On the Hill, a play about the death of Alex Nieto. Paul Flores, an activist and artist in San Francisco, wrote it.
We created On the Hill as a means of documenting what the young people of the mission have felt after they've learned about the police killing of Alex Nieto.
In March of 2014, Nieto was eating a burrito in a park. He wore a red 49ers jacket, his security guard outfit, and carried a licensed taser. He was a nightclub bouncer about to go to work. Then he got into an argument with a man, white, about the man's barking dog cornering Nieto and trying to eat his burrito. Another man in the park, also white, saw Nieto from a distance, allegedly agitated and holding his taser. He called 911 and described him as an armed Latino. The cops came. Nieto was killed minutes later.
My kids go to Flynn Elementary, which is three blocks away from Bernal Hill Park, where he was killed.
Flores and his kids were at a school event the night Nieto died.
The initial alarm was more not necessarily how close it was to school, but the fact that a Latino man had been shot at and killed in the neighborhood.
Nieto was from a once heavily Latino neighborhood that's now unaffordable for most locals. Rents have skyrocketed as Silicon Valley tech workers have moved in. The demographics have changed. And Flores and others here question if Nieto is profiled as a dangerous brown man in a neighborhood that's increasingly white. The autopsy report shows Nieto was killed by a hail of bullets.
We realized that he had been shot 14 times and that he was shot while he was actually laying on the ground.
Flores says that instead of taking the pain and limiting it to street protests, he's using it as an opportunity to create art. Flores worked with over a dozen young Latinos here to produce the play. They interviewed Nieto's friends and family. They talked to activists and lawyers galvanized by Nieto's death to bring justice to their streets.
So we wrote this poem called Don't Shoot, I'm Not Who You Think I Am. And that piece was really all the youth expressing how, regardless of whatever your statistics tell you, police officer, this is who I really am.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! I'm not who you think I am!
Since Nieto's death, there's been documentaries and concerts about him. There's graffiti of his face with Brown Lives Matter underneath. Flores says art helps keep Nieto's story alive.
Alex Nieto's death was a tragedy. It's something that should not have happened. And at the same time, he's now been converted into a symbol of resilience and community love.
This March, a federal jury found that the police officers who killed Nieto after firing over 50 bullets did not use excessive force. But this year, San Francisco's Board of Supervisors voted for the Department of Justice to conduct its own independent investigation into Nieto's death. The DOJ's decision on that is still pending. Meanwhile, the artists here are still creating. For the world, Shuka Kalantari, San Francisco.
You can hear from some of the artists behind On the Hill. We have a short documentary about them, produced by our friends at KQED in San Francisco. It's up right now at PRI.org. Coming up, what happens if you try to video the police in El Salvador with your smartphone? That's up later here on The World. When it comes to police shootings and terrorist attacks, a lot of us jump onto social media. You can get the details often while they're unfolding, as bystanders post images and videos of those events. It's unfiltered, but you may not know if what you're getting is accurate. Our next story is about one man whose death was greatly exaggerated. According to social media, he was a victim of the bombing at Ataturk Airport in Istanbul. He also died in the Egypt air crash and the Pulse nightclub shooting, and more. It's an epic troll of a real guy. Observers France 24, a part of the TV network France 24, tracked down the man in question. Gail Faure is an editor there.
Well, he's a young guy who lives in Mexico. He's Mexican, and he's alive and well, I have to say. But his photos have been used online, like you said, in several attacks. These photos were also used to portray him as a police officer accused of wrongdoings in Mexico. So clearly the trolls are finding lots of situations to put his picture out there.
How did your team track him down with just a few photographs?
We ran a Google image search, and our journalists started to contact the people who were posting his photos all over the place on Twitter and asking him, why are you sharing this guy's photo? And it turned out these people said that he was a former friend of theirs who had swindled them out of some money. And we managed to track him down, track his phone number down, and talk to him. And he said there was indeed a dispute over money and that these acquaintances had been trolling him relentlessly ever since.
Yeah. So is it fair to kind of characterize this as a major troll?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his photo's been popping up for like a year now and in, you know, pretty gruesome circumstances. So clearly he's not very pleased with the situation. And he told our journalist that he thinks the prank has gone way too far. And we asked him if he's ever filed a complaint, and he said he hasn't because he doesn't think it would go anywhere, and he doesn't seem to have much faith in the Mexican judicial system.
Apparently he's not very happy with the situation he's in.
No, he's not. He actually contacted the New York Times because his photo was used as a victim in one of their videos about the Orlando attack. And since then, they've actually taken his picture out of the video and put a correction. So that's one thing he's managed to do. But as far as actually getting justice in terms of the harassment he's gone from these online trolls, that he hasn't been able to do yet.
I mean, Gail, as an editor, you're dealing with credibility issues all the time. What does this say about the credibility of social media and the way people on the net respond, sometimes mockingly, to tragedies?
Well, honestly, you know, every time there is a tragedy like this, we do see hoaxes coming out. I mean, a lot of people share correct information, but there's always going to be a few people who want to, for one reason or another, to disseminate false information. Sometimes it's to get revenge on people. Sometimes it's just as they seem to get out a kick of trying to fool people and to fool media outlets that they might see as untrustworthy.
This is one incident emanating from Mexico. Are there hot spots around the world where this is happening a lot, this kind of trolling?
You know, we verify images from all over the world, and we see hoaxes all over the place. There's often images that we notice online or that are sent to us even directly that show conflicts in one country and that'll be used to illustrate a conflict in a totally different country. So people will sometimes use these gruesome images to try to advance their agendas.
Any suggestions or advice for people who do get a lot of their news from social media?
Honestly, the easiest thing you can do to check what you're contemplating sharing on social media, retweeting and reposting, is to take that photo and put it through Google image search. It's really easy, and that way you see if it's been used in other contexts before, if it's been published in the past.
Gail Faure, an editor with Observers France 24, a part of France 24 TV. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We've been hearing a lot of ominous stories about the Rio Summer Olympics starting up in a few weeks. We've told a few of them ourselves. The latest is about super bacteria in the Olympic waters there. That's a potential health hazard for rowers, and the U.S. crew team has been given antimicrobial suits for protection. That's just one piece of the story. The athletes themselves are still psyched to compete. So let's hear a story now about a pair of rowers who have been training right here in Boston on the Charles River. Here's my WGBH colleague, Craig Lamolt.
Andrew Campbell temporarily dropped out of Harvard in the second semester of his junior year. He wasn't in any kind of trouble. He did it because he was busy trying to qualify for the 2012 London Olympics. He and his partner in a two-person crew boat managed to qualify for a single race that could have sent them to the Games.
People call it the regatta of death.
In the end, they came in third. They missed qualifying by just a few feet.
And so that was a really hard experience, training all that time, dedicating my whole life, leaving my friends at school to go and do this, and then coming up just short was definitely heartbreaking.
A week later, at his coach's urging, he was back in a boat. Campbell loves rowing, despite its challenges.
It's incredibly painful, and the training can be very dull. It can be very repetitive, and there are often moments where I'm thinking to myself, why am I doing this? And I think what has driven me the most is trying to be a little bit better than the yesterday version of myself.
That drive eventually led him to a race this May in Sarasota, Florida, in a boat with new partner Josh Kinesny, and a second shot at going to the Olympics.
So you have to know that is going through his mind in the last couple strokes. He wants to punch his ticket. He does not want to come up short once again.
And he didn't.
And the yellow boat from Cambridge has done it. Andrew Campbell, Josh Kinesny are headed to Rio.
I got out of the boat, vomited from exhaustion. Like, it was a nasty, nasty race, and it took everything in me to get that qualification.
And now they're training for the real thing. Campbell and Kinesny use the power of their legs, shoulders, and back to pull the oars in perfect unison, propelling their boat down the Charles River towards downtown Boston.
You guys have been getting better with those shoulders. Why don't we stick with that? Keep sticking with that on these longer rows.
Their coach, Scott Roop, holds a cone to his mouth and calls out to them. Campbell and Kinesny aren't what you might picture from Olympians, in that they're not huge. They're both 5'10 and weigh in the 150s, so they row in the lightweight category, which the U.S. hasn't had a great record in recently. The last time we qualified to even send a boat in the men's lightweight doubles was 2004.
So the fact that they're going is some evidence that they're quite good, and they're just trying to creep in there, you know, get closer and closer. That's what you do.
As their boat speeds along towards Boston, the river widens, the wind picks up, and the water gets choppier. They take a rest near the Museum of Science, and Campbell calls out.
It's a bit bouncy here in the basin.
That bounciness is something they're used to by now, and they've developed a unique way of dealing with it. It's something Campbell picked up in a Harvard class on Chinese philosophy, Taoism.
And the way of the Tao is strength through suppleness. And so we used to be terrible at rowing in a crosswind, which is the most difficult conditions. And we've improved a lot by just relaxing, letting the boat move under us, and trying to make the best of the situation on top of the water.
Here's Kinesny.
How it works typically is the boat will get a little bit unstable, and either Andy or I will just say Tao, and then we just relax a little bit more and get into the groove.
Campbell says on a great day, he feels like they can make it to the podium in Rio. So now, as they put in hour after hour of practice on the Charles, he says it's all about trying to make great days a much more common occurrence. For The World, Craig LaMalt, Boston.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Evangelical Church got a big boost in Guatemala under a Pentecostal president who conducted a bloody civil war.
It's just that awkward relationship of power and evangelical zeal and anti-communism.
That story coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've been talking today about the police and police relations with the communities they patrol in the wake of two high-profile shootings of African Americans this week. Well, imagine if heavily armed police patrolled your neighborhood round the clock. You saw them on the way to the store, on your way home from work. That's what it's like in some poor neighborhoods in El Salvador's capital. The Salvadoran police and security forces have been out in force in recent months to crack down on gang violence. But in one suburb, Soyapango, the heightened police presence has many residents on edge.
They're more afraid of the police and the soldiers because, as one of them put it, at least the criminals go to jail and we don't see them anymore. But the police and the soldiers don't. They're never sent away for the bad things that they do here.
That's Salvadoran American Susan Cruz. She helps youth in trouble with the law in El Salvador and the U.S. Cruz spent a day with some young women in Soyapango last month and listened to their concerns.
One young woman named Gloria told me about a young man in her block who was walking down the street, and the police stopped him and they searched him as they always do. But this time they took some money from his pocket and they took his cell phone. So he went to the local police station to file a complaint because he wanted his cell phone back and he wanted his money. The police took him to the back. They beat him up, hit him in the head to the point that he was almost knocked unconscious. And they took photographs of him and they told him that if he followed through with the complaint, that they knew where to find him.
As we've seen in St. Paul and Baton Rouge, bystanders videoed on their cell phones what was happening with those cases of police abuse. Is that even in the realm of possibility for these teenagers in Soyapango?
I asked that question. How likely are you to use a cell phone and take video of these abuses? And they said, oh, we can't do that here because the police will come up to us, take our cell phones, literally snatch them from our hands and look through them. And we can't say anything about it because then they'll just walk away with their phones and they will use our pictures. They will use our information that's on our cell phones against us. It's not like we feel safe taking video of the police because who are we going to give it to?
Is it just a few bad apples, or are there some police, a lot of police, who are protecting people in Soyapango from the gangs?
There are police officers stationed in other neighborhoods that are not like Soyapango, that are perhaps middle-class neighborhoods, and you don't see the same type of behavior. And I think it goes back to last year's decision by the Salvadoran government not to prosecute police officers who shoot and kill allegedly in self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, as I think about African-American communities here in the U.S., I think about communities of kids in Soyapango. I mean, you met two young ladies named Lucy and Sophia. There they are in this neighborhood. What'd they tell you what it's like to live there, especially in this police crackdown?
So these two girls, they told me about how they've had to change everything about how they go about their days. You know, walking to and from school, being catcalled or sexually harassed by the police. Now, you know, their family members are walking them to and from school. They also echoed the sentiment that we're more scared of the police because they don't get in trouble.
Yeah.
They can do whatever they want to us.
Susan, you've been on The World several times and talked about your youth involvement in a street gang. I know that's far behind you, but it's probably given you a lot of insight into the relationship of the police to gangs, how to create a different sort of dynamic. What occurs to you?
What occurs to me is a comparison of what's happening with the police here in the United States. Since Ferguson, there's been a lot of talk about implicit bias and how difficult it is to overcome that. You can't just send someone to a cultural sensitivity class and undo years and years of indoctrination. You can't erase their thoughts and feelings and values that they have a specific class or a specific racial or ethnic group. And so I think the same holds true with law enforcement in El Salvador. They have also been indoctrinated to hold these strong beliefs about young people that live in poor communities. So they also feel justified that they have to protect themselves.
These young women you met in Soyapango, what did you learn about their dreams and aspirations? I mean, how do they see their futures with all this stuff going on around them?
The youngest girls, the youngest was 12, and there were a couple of 14-year-olds and a 15-year-old. They still had dreams that were very much linked to staying in El Salvador. Here are these young women who were asking for so little to be able to set up a small business in their home, to be able to have access to education, to be able to really learn the necessary steps to become an entrepreneur or to do other things. And I thought about how is it that we can link the Salvadoran diaspora primarily, which is over 2 million strong here in the U.S., and young women like these who had these dreams and they knew sort of what the steps were, but they just didn't have access to them. And I see a ray of hope there, because what these girls and these young women need is not a big ask. It wouldn't require, you know, an entire political campaign, you know, to make it happen.
Salvadoran American Susan Cruz, always good to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting these young women voice their concerns.
Next door in Guatemala, it's been 20 years since the official end of their civil war. An estimated 200,000 people died, most of them civilians. The war changed the country in all sorts of ways. One of the most surprising may be the way it influenced the religious faith of Guatemalans. Latin America is overwhelmingly Catholic, but Guatemala has turned toward evangelical Christianity. Amy Bracken explores what happened.
Sometimes I think I hear gunfire and bombs in Guatemala, but it's just that fireworks are really popular here.
strange as it seems in a population recently shell-shocked by so much war. This is Nebach in the Maya Ishil Highlands, an area particularly hard hit by the violence of the 70s and 80s. Miguel de Leoncetto was born here, but his family fled to Mexico when he was 1 year old. When he finally came back, he was a teenager, and there was something that particularly puzzled him.
When I returned to Guatemala, and specifically Nebach, one thing that surprised me a lot was how many evangelical churches there were. There were so many. For me, it was something strange, something new.
De Leoncetto is now a PhD student living in Guatemala City, writing a dissertation on the role of religion here. He says the war had a lot to do with the rise of evangelicalism. For one, the government targeted the Catholic Church because it was seen as siding with insurgents.
En un momento sí hubo el interés de neutralizar a la población, digamos, de despolitizar a la gente, ¿no?
The military wanted to neutralize, depoliticize the population, and many priests were assassinated in this country. So the evangelical church grew exponentially during the war. It was an extraordinary growth. And also many people turned to evangelicalism to save their lives. I mean, if you join the evangelical church, the military won't bother you.
In 1982, Guatemala got its first evangelical president when Army General Efraín Ríos Montt came to power in a coup. He was known for his beans and guns policy, feeding and arming sympathizers to help him fight the rebels. Stephen Elliott knows this history because he grew up in Nebach, the son of American missionaries who were personal friends of Ríos Montt.
It's just that awkward relationship of power and evangelical zeal and anti-communism.
Elliott says his father spoke out about the military's abuses, but both his parents continued to support Ríos Montt because he was evangelical.
And it was actually characteristic of most evangelicals here that they, to this day, remain pro-Ríos Montt just because he was an evangelical.
But not all evangelicals supported Ríos Montt. I met Antonio Cabacaba, a farmer and activist, on a rainy day in June in Nebach. He was just 11 when the war reached him in Ilom, a nearby village. After 95 people were massacred there, he was among the children the military brought to see the bodies, a warning not to collaborate with guerrillas. He says the images never left him, and there's no question in his mind it was part of an effort by Ríos Montt and others to destroy his people.
Si hablamos de los Antiguos Testamentos, ¿quién era el que discriminaba al pueblo de Israel?
In the Old Testament, who was persecuting the people of Israel? Egypt, the Pharaoh. And who was the other enemy? The Philistines. They were trying to eliminate the population, and that's exactly what we lived. Our Philistine is Ríos Montt.
Today, Cabacaba is one of the people trying to bring the ex-president to justice for atrocities committed around the country. It's confusing to try to sort out how a religion exploded in some of the darkest days of a country's history. Miguel de Leoncetto, the PhD student, sees the rise of evangelicalism as an insult to local Mayan traditions. But he also believes the Protestant Church has played an important role in post-war Guatemala.
En un país que vivió una guerra como esta, creo que la peor en América Latina en el siglo pasado.
In a country that lived through a war that I think was the worst in Latin America in the last century, there's no emotional rehabilitation or care program. So much of the trauma, much of the pain, is expressed in the evangelical church because it's the only place where you can cry and yell because there's no other space.
These days, expressions of evangelicalism are easy to find here in the Maya Ishil region. In the town of Chajul, my bus is slowed by a crowd spilling into the street, women in traditional vivid broidery and men in neat straw hats. It's a funeral in one of the evangelical churches, bringing a blend of joy and sadness to this otherwise quiet town. For the World, Amy Bracken, Guatemala's Western Highlands.
When you ask people around the world what's the thing that most affects their daily lives, a lot of them might say corruption. It's a huge issue in Ukraine. So while the country is battling Russia-backed separatists in the east, it's also fighting another war against corruption. And key to that battle is a new kind of customs official. Nick Schifrin reports from the country's largest port in Odessa.
This is going to be the open customs.
Yes.
So what does that mean, an open customs area or an open customs terminal?
It means the new attitude to business.
26-year-old Yulia Marszewska has never been a customs officer before. She's never been a politician before, but she was appointed as deputy governor in charge of cleaning Odessa's notoriously corrupt customs house.
There are a lot of people with a huge experience who worked in this country after the collapse of Soviet Union. But what did they achieve? What are the results? The most corrupt customs in the Eastern Europe, guys? I don't think that that's something to be proud of.
Odessa's been compared to Chicago under Al Capone, full of mafia and local officials in bed with them. And for decades, the Odessa port facilitated $40 million a month of graft that greased the wheels of power.
The intelligence forces, the police, the prosecutors, all other enforcement agencies, they were free to come.
So arms of law enforcement were becoming tools of corruption, tools
yes.
of the corrupt society.
Yes, yes.
Ukraine's old system was so broken, the new government turned to complete novices untainted by prior politics. Marszewska embodies Ukraine's pro-European ambitions. She's young and became the face of the revolution in Kiev 2 years ago.
I am the Ukrainian, the native of Kiev, and now I am on Maidan.
She and her viral video were at the center of the 2014 Maidan Revolution, which toppled a pro-Russian and deeply corrupt government. Her anti-corruption call to arms was viewed almost 9 million times.
We want to be free from the politicians who work only for themselves.
She's quickly discovered winning was easy. Governing is harder.
On Maidan, I thought that everything can be done only with your will and wish to change. And now I understood that it is a huge job to do. It's
a huge job, which is where that open customs area comes in. The U.S. is helping pay for customs workers' retraining and replacing workers susceptible to corruption with computers. Procedures will be simplified to prevent graft. But when you fight corruption, corruption fights back.
For example, all this simplification of procedures faced great resistance and even persecution from the central government.
She accuses the chief Ukrainian customs officer, a member of the central government, of trying to block her reforms by installing spies as her deputies.
Your own boss was sending people to spy on you.
To spy and to control. That's this old practice of a criminal's world when they're sending their people to watch what's happening.
So long as the old elites are still in power, it's not clear whether she can succeed. Her main ally is the local governor, who's even more of an outsider than she is.
This country had had unchanged elite for 25 years. These guys, they miserably failed the country. They turned it into the poorest country in Europe.
That's Mikhail Shakashvili. Only a year ago, he was appointed governor of Odessa and granted Ukrainian citizenship in order to fight corruption. He made his name as the president of the former Soviet state, Georgia, fighting Russian President Vladimir Putin. Today, he's still a thorn in Russia's side, but his most pointed criticism is for fellow Ukrainians.
I don't think Putin can defeat Ukraine. I think Ukraine can snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. It can only defeat itself.
He accuses the politicians who have been running the country of widespread corruption. Last December, in a cabinet meeting, he called the interior minister a thief. That's the sound of the interior minister throwing a glass of water at Shakashvili. For Shakashvili, Ukraine's fight against corruption is just as life and death as the fight on the front lines against separatists.
And what happens if you fail?
Ukraine has no option to fail because it would lead to disintegration of the country.
That disintegration is exactly what customs official Marszewska is trying to prevent.
It's war of past and future, war against corruption, war against this old way of thinking, war against Soviet heritage, and war for a modern Ukraine.
For a modern Ukraine. If she succeeds, she hopes her reforms become contagious to other Ukrainian institutions. But if the old system wins, Ukraine may never get the chance to fix itself again. For The World, Nick Schifrin, Odessa, Ukraine.
Nick's report is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. It's been a week to remind us that the war in Iraq is far from over. A massive suicide bombing on Sunday made that painfully clear. And yesterday, Britain weighed in with a damning investigation into the origins and conduct of the war, the Chilcot Inquiry. Seth Moulton always opposed the war in Iraq, but in 2003 he was a Marine Corps infantry officer at the beginning of the invasion, so he did his duty. Moulton eventually served four tours in Iraq and was decorated for valor. Now he's a U.S. congressman, a Democrat from right here in Massachusetts. We called him up to get his take on political leadership and war, but we started by asking him why he thinks the U.S. hasn't had its own Chilcot inquiry.
Well, it's a good question, and I think that we do need to examine decisions like this. There have been a lot of inquiries, if not congressional inquiries, into the decision-making that led up to 2003 and the invasion. So it's something that as a community, as a society in America, we absolutely do examine. But I also think it's important that we recognize our mistakes of the past, but don't necessarily try to pretend that 2016 is 2003 again. But we've got to deal with the situation as it exists now, and we've got to make sure that we can fix it in a way that we don't have to continue going back to Iraq year after year after year.
You're not the only politician critical of the Iraq war. The presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump has consistently opposed it since the invasion. How do you feel about being in the same company?
I don't consider myself in the same company at all. Donald Trump just praised Saddam Hussein. I mean, he has praised Kim Jong-un. He has praised Vladimir Putin. He basically wants to ally himself with some of the worst dictators of the past century. I'm not in that company at all. I risked my life to fight against people like that.
So as a congressman, if you're ever called on to vote on whether the United States should go to war, what questions would you definitely want answered?
I want to understand what our mission is. And that means, what is the real intent behind what we're doing, and what is the end game? What goal are we trying to achieve? I don't think that that was very clear in 2003, and I'm afraid it's still not clear today. But, you know, I want to say one more thing about Donald Trump while we're on the line. Shortly after we invaded Iraq, we came south to Hilla. And shortly after we arrived there, we discovered the mass graves of tens of thousands just north of the city.
Wow.
When Saddam Hussein killed terrorists, these are the kinds of people that he killed. Tens of thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians. Those are the practices of quote-unquote killing terrorists that Donald Trump is praising today. And it just shows that not only does he have no clue about history, no idea about basic principles of foreign policy or how to keep America safe, it also shows that he's completely unfit to be our commander-in-chief.
Suppose the day comes that he is president. What do you tell young Marines, what do you tell Army officers to, you know, follow the commander-in-chief like you did in Iraq, even though you disapproved of the war?
Well, there's a difference between following a lawful order and an unlawful order. And I think that President Bush's judgment was poor, very poor, disastrously poor in sending us into Iraq. It wasn't fundamentally unlawful. And what Donald Trump has already said on the campaign trail that he will ask our servicemen and women to do, to torture our enemies, to kill innocent civilians just because they're related to terrorists, to completely disregard the Constitution and discriminate against people based on their religion, one of the fundamental tenets that the Founding Fathers said we couldn't violate. These things are fundamentally unlawful. And so actually, I know that Marines and soldiers out there are already talking about what it would mean to disobey the orders of a commander-in-chief, Donald Trump, because the orders that he gives are against our own Constitution.
Former Marine and U.S. Congressman Seth Moulton, thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Finally today, a classic anti-war story, emphasis on classic, The Trojan Women by Euripides. And now there's a modern retelling of the ancient Greek drama on stage in London. It's performed by an unusual cast, 13 Syrian women, all refugees. They weave a mix of the original text with their own experiences of war. The BBC spoke with several of the performers, including Reem from Damascus. She's 25 and lives in Jordan.
We're not here to entertain you or sing a song. I have an anger and a message to pass to you. We came from the Troy of this age, or even worse. We lost our home. This part is very important for me, and I wrote it from deep in my heart because it's really represent me, the anger inside me, because of all what happened in my country.
The bombing started in our neighborhood, and there was actually a massacre, and there was around 200 just killed immediately, and it was continuously happened, and the next morning we just left our house and we just go from place to another place in Syria, but each place will be unsafe again, and it's end with us after 7 months to go outside of Syria to Jordan. It was so hard.
I'm Sham. I'm 37 years old. I'm a pharmacist. I have 4 children. One of them, when she heard the sound of bombing, she was holding me. She treats my shirt because of the fear. But we have to have a new beginning just for our children. The message on the play that I hope to pass to the English audience, that Syrian women are very strong. They have the power of love.
The lessons from the history, from the past age, they're just repeating the same fault and the same wrongs. This play, it's let us discover something inside us we didn't know about us. Not like what the community wants us to be. It's something that was hidden and just come up. I think it's strength, trust, anger, a lot of anger and hope.
And love. We heard there from Reem and Sean, two Syrian refugees who are performing in London in a modern retelling of the Trojan Women. They spoke with the BBC's Marilyn Rust. And that's where we leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
PRI, Public Radio International.